Welcome back to Speaking with Authority. Real excited about who I have on today. One of the things that I find is the biggest gap in leadership isn't a knowledge gap. It isn't a talent gap. It isn't even an opportunity gap. It's the gap between knowing what to do and actually doing it. Every leader listening has lived inside that gap. You've read the books, taken the courses, built the strategy, run the offsite, and execution is something that keeps slipping. My guest today has built an entire career inside that gap. Dre Baldwin is a former professional basketball player, internationally recognized keynote speaker, and author of more than 43 books, and the founder of Work on Your Game. His work has reached millions with a message that is both simple and inconvenient. Success is less about what you know and more about what you're willing to do on the days that you don't really feel like it. So what got my attention about Dre wasn't the highlight reel or the follower count. It was his refusal to let people hide behind the word motivation. He talks about discipline, accountability, and execution the way a coach does, with no escape hatch. Today, we're going to move past the productivity. We'll move past the productivity hacks and the quote cards, I guess, if you will. And we're going to get into the mindset behind execution, how leaders create alignment before action, and the danger of executing brilliantly on the wrong thing, and what actually separates the people who win from the people who keep almost winning. Dre, welcome to Speaking with Authority.
Jim, I am excited to be here. Thank you for having me. Hopefully I can live up to that introduction.
You're going to do great. You're awesome. I've watched hundreds of your videos. You are somebody I'm just excited to get to know. Every speaker kind of has an origin story they tell on stage, and I want to kind of go behind that story. What's the version most audiences never get to hear?
Well, a lot of people, Jim, think my origin story is based on kind of what you said in the introduction about execution and getting things done, or motivation, or even discipline. And then they may take that to another level, let's say confidence. But that's not the real story. The real story is about all the time I spent without a guarantee or knowing what the next step was going to be or what the outcome was going to be, and me continuing to show up despite the fact of the uncertainty in front of me. So the old saying is, you don't have to see from Miami to Los Angeles to drive there. All you have to see is the road in front of you. And for me, it was just, what is the next step that I can take? Because in my career, whether it was going from playing college sports to playing pro sports, it was from not being known in the space, let's say in the basketball space, to getting known in the entrepreneurship space, the same thing, the speaking space, the author space, the thought leadership space. I spent more time, let's just say from the time I graduated college in 2004 to now, I've spent more time without the success than with the success. Mm-hmm. More time where there was no guaranteed outcome than with a guaranteed outcome. Yet I kept showing up every single day during those processes, and then the ups more than made up for the downs, even though there were more downs than there were ups. We were just counting in volume. There was much more time down than there was time up. So it's the willingness and ability to keep showing up despite this that has really been the, if I had to put one signature, let's say, on my story, it's that more than anything else.
Yeah. Why do you think that's so hard for most people? I mean, why do people give up, you know?
Human beings have a need for certainty. It's one of the basic human needs, is we need to know what's going to come next. And this is the main reason why a lot of people may have aspirations or dreams of wanting to get into some type of entertainment type of career. Let's say athletes, singers, dancers, bands. These days now you have the influencers and the creators, the streamers. I think a lot of people want to get into those spaces because the job looks sexy from the outside looking in. The grass looks very green. You're making money. You have a lot of fans. It's serving your ego, because everywhere you go, well, many places you go, somebody's going to know you or recognize you. And when they hear about what you do, they're impressed, as opposed to if you're a plumber or a psychiatrist. It's cool, but that's not sexy. So a lot of people want to do those things. However, those jobs to get into those spaces requires a ton of uncertainty because only one in a million or so makes it. You never know when or if you're going to make it and how much you're going to make it, even if you do. And most people cannot deal with the anxiety, stress, and pressure that comes with trying to make it in that space, but not being there yet. And again, there's no set deadline on how long it's going to take for you to get there. If it was, hey, do this much, then you get there. Like being a doctor, okay, you go to medical school for this many years, then you do the residency, then you do this, now you're a doctor. Or if you want to be a lawyer, you go to this college and you go to this law school, then you pass the bar, now you're a lawyer. There's a set, clear path. But there's a lot of things in life for which there is no set, clear path. And yes, there is a certain amount of talent, knowledge, and activity required to get there. But a lot of people have all three, but they're not willing to deal with the unknown, that X in their mind. If you go back to algebra class, that X that you have to solve for in your mind, a lot of people can't deal with that for long enough to get to the end game.
That's really good. Yeah, I think a lot of it, I use a lot of music analogies, but I think before you play in a symphony, you've got to play in a fourth grade band. Before you play in the NBA or any type of a college basketball team, you've got to go through high school and you probably go through grade school, and you've got to spend a lot of time out on the court by yourself practicing before you get to that point. And a lot of people want to skip those steps.
Right. And it's not even so much, Jim, that they want to skip the steps. It's just they want to know that if I do take these steps, it's guaranteed to lead to the next step, next step, and next step. But these industries that I'm referring to that we're using as a canvas here, they don't have a guaranteed path. That's the very reason why so many people want it, because the end game looks so good, but many people fall off because there is no set path that you can follow to get there.
Now, you've built a brand around execution. Is there a real reason that people don't execute other than the not knowing the X? And if they don't actually want it as much, you know, is it a one? Is there other aspects to where there's something, a blocker keeping them from execution? I know that everyone wants that certainty, but is there something else?
Absolutely. It's actually everything other than not knowing. Not knowing is the least of the reasons why people don't execute. Even though if you ask most people, why are you not executing? About 70% of people will say is because I don't know. And 30% of people will be a little bit more honest and they'll say, well, I know I'm supposed to. I'm just not doing it. Ha ha. They'll laugh at themselves and pointing out that they're not doing it. But the real reason people don't execute is execution is a reflection of your beliefs. You do things that reflect what you actually believe. The simple analogy I use, Jim, is that if you leave the house in the morning and you walk 20 minutes to work and you have to walk 20 minutes home, and you believe, because you watch the news in the morning, that it's going to rain on your walk home, what do? You pack an umbrella because you believe it's going to rain. But if you don't bring the umbrella, that means you don't believe that it's going to rain. It's simple reflection of what you actually believe. It didn't happen yet, but if you think it's going to happen, you bring the umbrella just in case. Many people don't execute because they, for whatever reason, do not believe that this execution is going to lead to more pleasure than pain, to use a Tony Robbins analogy. They don't execute because it'd be easier to not execute, or the outcome of not executing will feel better to them in the long run than the outcome of executing. And that's the only thing that stops anybody from doing anything. Then you can branch into 100 different reasons why they have weighed the equation in that way.
Yeah. I think that's really good. There's a point where people think, I know I need to, I can see the vision in the back of my head as far as, you know, this is what I need to happen, but I put it off. I procrastinate. I'm interested, but I'm not committed.
Right.
Have you ever found that a lot of people are just really interested in doing something, but moving from the interest to the commitment, is there a change that happens, or is there a way that you help people get from just being interested to moving to that committed stage?
Buy-in. The difference between interest and committed is buy-in. And I was just talking to, I was just having lunch with a coaching client of mine the other day, and he plays poker. And he went to a poker tournament and he won. And he was kind of telling me how they go. I don't play poker. I understand what it looks like when they're playing, but I don't play. But he was telling me, what's the buy-in? I was asking, what's the buy-in to get into the game? Do you play poker, Jim, or understand it?
I've played it. I don't play professionally. I've played, you know, cards with guys. I understand Texas Hold'em. I understand it. But I'm not much of a gambler. But I understand buy-in. Yeah. There's different levels.
Right. So you understand to play a game of poker, if there's money involved, you have to put some money on the table to get in the game. Yep. You can't sit down without putting money on the table. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between interest and commitment. So when I go to, I'm in Vegas with a couple of my friends. I have a friend who plays poker. He sits down at the table because he puts money on the table. I stand around the table and watch him play. I'm interested, but I'm not committed because I don't play. So that's the difference. And the buy-in means you have to put something on the table that you are risking losing. So this is actually a good metaphor. Yeah. You're risking losing time, money, attention, energy, focus, the opportunity cost of everything else you could be doing when you buy into trying to make this thing work with no guarantee that it's going to work. This is the reason why a lot of people don't ever pass that, as we say, the point of no return in going after something, because they don't want to deal with the loss. Human beings are very not sensitive to losing things. And also the embarrassment of you knowing that other people may know that you tried and you failed, but it's not really about other people because, frankly, Jim, most people don't think about other people nearly as much as we think other people are thinking about us. We mostly think about ourselves. So the real embarrassment people have is you looking at yourself, knowing that you tried and failed, and then you projecting that embarrassment onto others, thinking that they're thinking about you when they're really not. But just the feeling that you feel about yourself is enough. That suffices to keep people from committing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love what Mr. Beast said a while back. He said, your first 100 videos on your YouTube, they're going to be terrible, but you can't get to the good ones until you get through the bad ones. And it's always development. You learn how to play. Any skill is something that you've got to start poorly at and continuously improve. And I think the challenge psychologically that a lot of people have is they're afraid. They've got an ego involved. They've got, they don't want to be embarrassed. There's a little bit of shame. So all of those emotions are coming into play. Now, do you think skill is something, or discipline is a skill that can be taught, or is it just a decision that most people either make or they don't?
Neither one. Discipline is a byproduct of structure. Discipline is a description of behavior. That's what discipline actually is, the same as with confidence.
Yeah.
And the reason why many people come up short on both of these is because they have incorrect formulas, inaccurate formulas as to how, what they are, and then, of course, they go about incorrectly how to get them. Mm-hmm. So in my experience, Jim, a lot of people want confidence, but they're seeking discipline. And I'm bringing confidence into this because they actually are connected. So in my background in sports, a lot of athletes will come to me, they would get performance anxiety. I want to be more confident during the game. Mm. How do I do that? Yeah. What do I think about? What do I say to myself? What music do I listen to? Mm. Thing is, discipline, let's go back here, upstream. Discipline is a byproduct of structure.
Okay.
When you're following a clean structure, such as given to you by a coach, such as given to you by a boss or working at a job, such as when you plug into somebody's system, the system is the structure. As long as you are capable of following directions and you follow those directions consistently, then your behavior is uniform. And uniform behavior to the outside observer looks like, wow, that person is disciplined. That's what most people say. This person shows up every day and does their job. So then you ascribe that behavior to the individual. You say, well, since they do this, that's who they are. That's a disciplined person. I remember I came to the gym here in Miami one day. It was one of these holidays. It was 4th of July, Memorial Day, one of these holidays. And the gym opened later, like 8 in the morning instead of 5 in the morning. And I get there and one of the co-owners of the gym opened the gym that day. And she knew who I was. So she had seen me before. And she saw me that day. And she said, you're here working out today? I said, yeah. She said, you're very disciplined. That's what she said. You're very disciplined. And many people ascribe discipline to me as a personality trait, but it's not really a personality trait. It's a reflection of my behavior. My behavior is disciplined. So they assume that I'm a disciplined person. So to answer your question, discipline is not something that is an individual trait. Anybody can exhibit disciplined behavior. All you have to do is have a structure and follow it, whether it's one you created for yourself or one that is handed to you. Now, the reason I'm bringing up confidence, Jim, is because discipline produces confidence. When you follow structured behavior consistently, your behavior becomes uniform discipline. Confidence is a belief in your ability to do something. Where do you get that belief from? From the fact that you have done your homework by doing the work consistently. So now when it's time to perform, you have a belief in your ability to execute. That's where your behavior looks how people describe as confident. And all confidence is an embodiment of your structure and discipline to where you are not concerned about, can I do this? I'm not sure. What are people going to think? That absence of self-consciousness is what people read as confidence. So this person's very confident, but that's not not a personality trait. It's a byproduct of things that most people don't see.
I think that's really good. One of the things that I do a lot of is I work with a lot of people in recovery, a lot of addicts. I've been clean and sober for 36 years. And so I get to work with a lot of people who are trying to get sober. And they say, well, I'm just not disciplined. And I have to stop right there. And I said, listen, I know your story, and I've never seen a more disciplined person in my life. And they're kind of taken back. And I said, the discipline that you took to get high every single day was something that I've never seen anybody go through other than another addict. So it's not a discipline issue. It's not. It's your structure. It's your framework. But You're wanting that reward so bad, that dopamine hit or whatever you're looking for, that you will go through any length, come hell or high water, to get that feeling that you want. Now, if we change your beliefs to where you start thinking about sobriety and that change behavior, the structure, if you will, the system, if you will, it's kind of like a trellis. Yeah. Vines grow on a trellis. It's a structure that people will gravitate to. So that's just a brilliant analogy. I really appreciate that, Dre.
Yeah, thank you. It's the buy-in, Mikey, that's just right. Said that we talked about earlier.
When a leader says, my team won't execute, the conversation you have with that leader before they blame the team sounds like what?
The first thing is I need to find out what exactly is the goal. What do you want to be happening? And what do you think is causing the problem? Those are the first things. First two things I want to know anytime somebody comes to me asking for any form of help. What's the goal and what's the problem? So they say their team won't execute. That sounds like a problem, but I would dig a little bit more. And then I want to know, what do you want them to do? You want them to execute well on what? And then I find out. And then ultimately I'm going to ask the leader, what are the habits and behaviors that your team is seeing from you? Because anytime somebody comes to me with a challenge, the first thing I'm looking at is the person who came to me with the challenge, Even if the challenge is based on some third party who is not present. Mm-hmm. So what is the team seeing from you? What behaviors are you exhibiting? What are you modeling? What are you allowing? What are you tolerating? What are you enforcing? What are you upholding? What are you correcting? Once I start asking those questions, usually about five questions in, the leader knows that this conversation is not about the team anymore. It knows about them. So that's where I would start.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Can a leader honestly demand accountability from a team? They're privately not living that life in themselves. You know, be blunt. Don't give me the polite answer. If you're talking to somebody that doesn't have self-awareness, that they're setting an example, how do you draw that out of them? Is just asking questions, or is there a technique or a tactic that you use on that?
Well, we can look at this in a couple of different ways, because the accountability from the team is based on not the leader themselves as a person, is based on the system. So the system is, this is how you do your job. To employee number 10, this is how you do your job. These are the 7 steps you need to follow every single time this happens. So whether I am following my steps as a leader is irrelevant to whether you're following your steps. And I, as the leader, my job is to make sure that you are following the structure. If you follow the structure, then we know what kind of results we should expect to get over an extended period of time. So it's harder that way because you add friction. You add this mental, spiritual, so to speak, layer of friction if you are not living the way that you're trying to hold other people accountable to living. But that is still ultimately, when I'm talking to the employee, that's irrelevant. You think your boss is not living what they're preaching, so you still work there. You're just getting a paycheck, right? They're paying you. Okay, is this your job description? Are you doing it? And if you're not doing your job, you're going to get fired. That's the way it works, regardless of how you feel. If you're not doing what the job tells you to do, you won't have a job. So again, your personal feelings are allowed, but your personal feelings are irrelevant to you doing your job.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. Is there a leadership habit that looks really good, like looks great leadership, but actually destroys execution?
That's a great question. A habit that looks good but destroys execution. Well, getting your team fired up and motivated, it looks good. I wouldn't say it destroys execution, but it doesn't do anything to execution, while at the same time, it is using up energy, time, attention, and focus. So ultimately, you weigh the opportunity cost to what you're getting from it, then it does ultimately hurt execution because you're not helping execution in the process that you're doing other things. And you may invest money into that. You may go hire some outside speaker for that. Maybe you went and read a book. You went to a conference. You took a bunch of notes. Now you want to get the team all fired up. It's not that motivation doesn't work. Motivation does work. The challenge is motivation is temporary and motivation is fickle. It shows up when it feels like it. And motivation, you cannot build a career or a longstanding business process on motivation because it doesn't show up consistently enough. Motivation can be a good starter, but eventually it must hand its job over to structure, which produces discipline. Discipline you can build a career on. You cannot build on motivation.
I love that. I love what Jim Rohn said. He said, motivation alone is not enough. If you motivate an idiot, now you have a motivated idiot. Right. Help me understand managing people versus leading people. Give me a one sentence difference in the two. What's the difference between managing and leading?
The difference between managing and leading is when you lead, people do what you want them to do because they want to do it. When you manage, they do what they have to do because they are forced to do
it. Right. What do high-performing teams do on a Tuesday at 2 p.m. that average teams don't do?
They are following a system that has an overlay of enforcement and correction so that when someone goes off the script of the system, it is immediately caught, corrected, and the execution of the system is enforced. That's the reason the team is high performing, not because necessarily of the talent of the individuals involved.
Yeah. Don't you find like accountability is something I don't want the leader to do the accountability. I want a system to do the accountability. I want a dashboard. I want this. No one wants they're handheld or they don't want a brutal taskmaster or, you know, a micromanager. Mm-hmm. They want somebody they want a system that they can see, okay, on the dashboard, like, oh, wow, you know, my sales are down. I'm not ranking as high as everyone else. Or this is my project management tool that I'm saying, I need to get this done by the end of the week. Don't you think that is a better way of leading is to develop a system that everyone has visibility on?
Yes, and what makes it better, most importantly, when dealing with human beings is that now the accountability is not about how I feel about you or how you feel about me. It's about what the system says and are you adhering to the system? So now it becomes an objective, black and white, impartial thing rather than you thinking that I'm picking on you or somebody thinking that I never call this person out when they're wrong. And doesn't have to do with my mood, doesn't have anything to do with your mood. The system itself is telling you what it is. So again, my background is in sports. And in sports, you're judged by the scoreboard, not by the people.
Yeah.
I mean, people can judge you, but the ultimate arbiter is the scoreboard. The scoreboard has no personal opinions. It just tells you the truth.
Yeah. And sometimes you're going up against a difficult team, and the only way we get better is by going up there. But if you don't have a scoreboard, it's really difficult to hold yourself accountable. If you don't get into the game and play a game or have that, you can't see. I think that's a great analogy.
That's right.
One of the patterns I see all the time is people are working incredibly hard, but not on the same thing. So have you ever spent serious time climbing what turned out to be the wrong mountain? You have a story like that.
Yeah, I can give you a couple. So if I go back to my youth, before I started playing basketball, I played baseball. So that was the wrong mountain. And I didn't get too far up the mountain, good things. I wasn't that good. I didn't have a lot of talent. But eventually I realized I was in one of the principles we have over here is being in a proper vehicle. So you can work hard, have the right intentions, right ideas, right mindset, et cetera, but if you're driving in the wrong vehicle or you're on the train going in the wrong direction, you're not going to get to your destination. Yeah. So I had to get out of the wrong vehicle, and eventually I moved on into basketball. That became my sport. Going into the business world, I've been climbing up the wrong mountain. I remember I was climbing up the wrong mountain when I was doing a lot of speaking, probably my first 3 to 5 years after I stopped playing ball. So I stopped playing in 2015. So between 2015 and 2020, I did a whole lot of professional speaking to where I was actively every day in the CRM, sending emails, cold calling, and getting myself booked on stages. And it's not that it didn't work, Jim. I did a bunch of speaking gigs. I did a bunch of TED Talks. I did a bunch of free gigs that led to paid gigs. And my mentor told me that's how you know you're good is when you get off one stage and they try to book you for another stage. So I knew it was actually working. And whatever sense you want to give, it's working. The issue was I just didn't like the business model. It wasn't very much different than playing a sport, is that you're only as good as your last gig. And in sports, you're only as good as your last contract. So as soon as the contract ended, now I got to go get another one. And I had to get another one. And I'm not really building any, I don't like the fact that I wasn't really building any long-term equity just by speaking. Like, you can't pass the speaking gig on to your kids. So I was just trying to figure out what's the next thing here. So around the time of 2020, when everything shut down, and there weren't any speaking gigs for a minute, I started focusing on what had been sitting in the back of my mind. Because the other thing I didn't like about that industry is that the decision makers were the ones who really controlled your career. I didn't really control it. It was how well can I sell myself to the person making a decision? Mm-hmm. How can I put myself in control instead? And that's when I started working more on in-house things. That led to execution reliability, what we've been talking about, more coaching, more consulting, more things where people are coming into my ecosystem and getting my stuff rather than me just taking my speaker for hire self and farming myself out to other people's platforms, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, the speaking world it can be brutal. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of challenges. And I've seen you speak. I've seen a lot of reels that you've done, and you're very, very good at it. In fact, one of the things that attracted me to inviting you on and doing this interview was you have an authenticity about you that a lot of people try and fake, and it just doesn't come across. I mean, you've got a true authenticity about you. I mean, when you're up giving a talk, there's a connection that I think people get from going through. I think authenticity comes from when somebody goes through struggles or challenges to get somewhere, whether it's, you know, lots of practice, going through and playing a lot of games that you didn't win, you know. Those are things that I think bring across that authenticity. But yeah, that speaking game can be brutal. And so what was your residual income aha moment in the 20s? What was some of the things in your back pocket that you thought, this is something where I want to change mountains and climb this mountain?
Well, it's just simply understanding assets. I mean, financially, an asset is something that puts money in your pocket. So while I can go do a speaking gig, doing the gig does put money in my pocket. The problem is Dre Baldwin can only do one gig in one place at one time. Right? So it's only so many. It's a matter of how many times can I do a gig in a day? How many of those gigs can I sell? And how many places can I be at a time over the course of, let's say, a year? Okay, this is my max out. Now, am I willing to do that this much? And how long do I have to do this? Because I remember I was talking to a guy named Mark Eaton. Did you ever know him? Heard of him?
That sounds real familiar. How would I know Mark?
He used to play in the NBA, actually. He was 7 feet 4 inches tall. He played for the Utah Jazz for, I think, most of his career. He's an older guy. He's probably in his 60s, maybe close to 70. Mm-hmm. And he actually passed away about 6-7 years ago in a bicycle accident. But I spoke to him probably in 2017 or 18 on phone. And I was reaching out to him to find out how he was able to consistently stay booked in the speaking world. Yeah. And he said to me, well, Dre, I see you're doing a lot of online stuff. You have courses and coaching and things like that. And you have this brand online. You have a name on the internet where people can learn from you and give you money for things without you having to actually go talk to them and shake their hand. He said, I got the exact opposite problem from what you have. You're looking to get on stages. I'm looking to do what you're doing, because he's 30 years older than me. And he's like, hey, how am I ever going to retire? Because I got to keep doing speaking gigs. That's what he said to me. So I took from that conversation, hey, this is more confirmation of what I'm looking to do. I need to create assets. So that's when I focus even more on making books, making courses, making programs. And these days our focus is on really creating a system to where companies can access it through licensing, where they can access the dashboard, the materials, the process They don't need to know me. They don't need to shake my hand, but they're using a system that I created and nobody even knows that I made it. That's where I want to be over the next 10 to 20 years of my career, to where the money is being made, but the money is not based on me being some flashy superstar on the stage. It's not that I won't do that stuff, but the asset needs to be bigger than me as a person. If I'm the only asset, the problem is if I want to go on vacation and the money stops coming in. So I didn't want to be in that position forever. And I knew in the speaking business, that's the position I was in.
Yeah, it's kind of that analogy. I'd rather have $1 from a million people than $1 million from one person.
Exactly. Know?
It's a different thing. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, communication, authority, and influence. The show is called Speaking with Authority, and it's a double entendre. And the reason why I thought of that is, one, I want to interview people who are good at speaking. You know, mm-hmm. I want somebody who has got up on stage and spoke, but I also want somebody who is an authority on something.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge sometimes when you think about it is, what gives a person the right to speak with authority? What makes us see right through somebody who's trying to fake it? I just want to think about that and flesh that out with you.
Sure. Well, the first thing, what gives somebody the authority to speak on something? I say nothing. I say that's an oxymoronic question, because authority is taken. Authority is not given. It's taken. You take authority. You assume authority. Same way you assume the lead. Same way you assume leadership. Nobody's going to hand it to you. If somebody handed it to you, you don't really have it because they gave it to you. That means they can take it away. So authority, by definition, Merriam-Webster says, the power to influence or command thought, opinion, or behavior. So again, power is another thing that is taken. It is assumed. It is not granted. It is not given. If someone grants you power, you don't really have power, because whoever gave it to you can take it from you.
Yeah.
So authority is about, what I tell people with authority is, you break down the word authority, you get the word author. And who's an author? A person who decides, keyword decides, to stand up and say, here's where I'm at. Here's where I stand. Here's what I think. Here's what I am asserting. And I'm going to put this on the table and you do whatever you want with it. I'm not asking you what you think. I'm telling you what I think. And you can take that home with you. That's authority. And that takes a certain amount of cojones. You got to have some confidence in yourself to be willing to do that, because you have no idea how the public is going to respond or if they're going to respond at all. That's how you get authority, by assuming it. In legal terms, a subject matter expert is, by definition, the person who knows the most about a subject in the room. So there's a person on an airplane who's dying, and a person stands up and says, hey, I'm a doctor, and he's actually a chiropractor, but there's nobody else with a higher level of medical experience than him, then he is the expert on that plane. He's the authority on that plane and that situation, because he knows more than anybody else. And he stood up and said, I know the way. He becomes the authority. So authority is taken. It is not given, and is not anyone else's opinion that determines whether you have authority or not. It's your opinion, and you give your opinion to everybody else.
You know that cold. How did you get to know that so well?
I talked about it a lot of times.
That's awesome. That's great. What piece of leadership advice do you hear consistently that you think is just flat out wrong?
One piece of leadership advice I hear consistently, I think, is flat out wrong. I think that so many.
Let me give you some context on that and what you're thinking about that. So,
okay.
A lot of times people think that they're a great leader, and they're going to lead because they are a micromanager, and they're going to lead because they're looking at tasks, and they don't understand about leading being, what is leadership? You manage projects, you manage tasks, you manage systems, you lead people. And another word for lead is influence. Can you influence another person? And I think that is more of a leadership, but there's lots of misconceptions on leadership and what leadership is and how do you develop leaders and things like that. I just wanted to think if there's one that just popped out in your head that you're always fighting against as far as that's not leadership.
Well, leadership is not the same as being a boss. Those are two different things.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, because if you look at the leaders who are most well known, people who are known for leadership, you look at a Steve Jobs, you look at Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, well known leaders, they're often known because they're somewhat abrasive. At least their public personas are abrasive. They are demanding. They're the type of people who will shout you down, cuss you out in front of the whole room if you're not doing what they want you to do. And they just lead by with an iron fist. They rule with iron fists. So people, when they're looking to emulate that, and these people have books written about them, they write their own books, they give speeches talking about this stuff, and they're held up as very successful people. So when you're held up as a successful person, especially to the wider public, there are people who will try to emulate what they see from you, but they're only emulating what they see on the surface. They're not emulating the things that really make things go. Those are not the parts that get advertised. What gets advertised is what people can see on the surface. So you see, Steve Jobs is known as really being a jerk. He would cuss people out. People would cry in their offices because of the way he would talk to them. And then people say, well, Steve Jobs did it. That means I can do it. But that's only part of what he did.
Yeah.
You didn't see the rest of what he did. You didn't see the focus that he had. You didn't see how he cut Apple's product line down to four products when he came back to save the company from insolvency. You didn't see how he had the vision for putting a phone, an MP3 player, and a computer together into one device. Those are the things that gave him authority, going back to our earlier question, to where people would listen to him. Because the guy was actually, and pretty much you could say he was a genius. Now, the fact that he was a jerk was icing on the cake, so to speak. He didn't have to be a jerk. That's just his personality. But that's not the reason why he led. That's just how he led. Leadership is about getting people to want to do your bidding because they want to appease you. They want to be next to you. They want to follow you. They're inspired by you. So despite the fact that Steve Jobs, I think most people would know who he is in your audience, right? He's the guy who created the iPhone, the Apple
guy. Steve Jobs again? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, so most people should know who he is. You can Google him if you haven't heard him. And the reason why people followed him is because of his excellence at what he did, the actual work that got to the end consumer. They didn't follow him because he would cuss people out and yell at them and because he would tell people their work was trash. That's not why they followed him, but that's the part that people know. So then they want to emulate that, but they don't want to emulate the rest of it. It's similar, Jim, to back in the days when I was playing basketball. I used to make a lot of basketball content on YouTube. So I had all these young athletes following me. And many of them would reach out to me and they would say something along the lines of, hey, I heard that Kobe Bryant or Kyrie Irving or Derrick Rose, whatever player, I heard that he did ABC drill when he was a kid. So I'm thinking, Dre, do you think it's a good idea if I do that drill? And this is the same thing people do with Steve Jobs. They take this little piece they heard and then they want to copy that, but they don't want to copy the system underneath the piece. So I would tell them, well, maybe he did do that drill, but he was probably also waking up at 5 a.m. to go lift weights before school. Are you doing that? He was probably also going outside and jogging 2 miles from home, then jogging 2 miles back before his workouts. Are you also doing that? He was probably also watching what he ate, not playing video games for 3 hours a day, not going to parties on the weekends so he could maximize on his physical abilities. Are you doing that part too? So you can't just pick and choose the parts that are interesting to you and the parts that are fun for you and then leave out all the other parts because now you're just picking and choosing. And it may be fun to do it, but you're not getting the entire system. So to lead, you need to know what actually makes leadership happen. And the biggest thing, to put a bow on this answer, to give you the true answer when it comes to leadership, Jim, is leadership is about the people on your team need to believe that you give a damn about them as people and where they want to go, not just how you can use them and what you can get out of them. If they believe that you're going to help them get to where they want to go, they will accept the fact that you're kind of a tyrant. I mentioned Steve Jobs. Michael Jordan is another great example. I'm sure many in your audience saw that documentary about Michael Jordan that came out about 6-7 years ago. In that documentary, Michael Jordan pretty much admitted, hey, I was a jerk. I cussed my teammates out. I pushed them beyond their limits. I pushed them to do things that they never would have did on their own, but I never asked them to do anything that I wasn't doing. And on top of that, the only reason I was pushing them to do that is because they saw that if we do what Mike's making us do, we're going to win. It starts with hard work and it ends with champagne. He would say that to his teammates during the playoffs. And they all won all those championships. All those guys made more money than they would have made with Mike. And all of them played better with Michael Jordan than any of them ever played without him. That's just an absolute fact. And that's the reason why all of them look back at him. If you watch that documentary, none of them say they're Michael Jordan's friend. None of them talk about him in a very positive way personally, but they all say, I got to pay respect because look what he did.
Well, I think there's an interesting part that you talked about. And if you're a leader and somebody knows that you care about them, that you support them, then it's very easy for them to receive a challenge from you. And you can't grow without support and challenge. The difficult part sometimes is Nick Saban, great football coach, but if I put him in front of the fourth grade band, he's not going to do well. he's not going to be a good leader in that environment. Mm-hmm. Hypothesis. That's my hypothesis, because the band doesn't know that they care about them. They're immature. It's a different environment. But if I put him in front of another football team, he's going to get people to really, really perform. And that's something with top people. A lot of times you've got this challenge, this paradox of somebody saying, well, if I had better people, I would be a better leader. Mm-hmm. But they don't know how to develop the people. And I always like using the analogy of one of the best leaders that I think is out there is a guy by the name of George Martin. Do you know who George Martin was?
No.
So he was a music producer, and he had these four guys that were terrible musicians that he worked with for a period of time, and he gave them the proper amount of support, but the proper amount of challenge. They had problems with relationships, divorces, girlfriends, drugs, showing up on time, all of these challenges that he had to overcome and deal with. But he still got something great out of them, because that little group was the Beatles. And they produced more songs in 7 years than anybody else did. A lot of times, leaders, I think, look at the generation or the team that they're leading, thinking, well, I just need to get better people. I just need to get better people. I just need to get people that can handle my challenge better. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand their role is to develop that group. And so I think there's a lot to what you said there as far as the challenge, that balance of supporting somebody but challenging them. That's very good.
Yeah, I agree. And that supporting them is also about the right vehicle. So that Nick Saban yeah. example, the right vehicle for him would be a college football locker room. The wrong vehicle would be that classroom. And there are people who would do great in the classroom. They would not get listened to in that college football locker room. So you have to get in where you fit in. That leadership in one place doesn't work the same way in another place. Even Nick Saban, he went to the NFL. That didn't work. And he came right back to college.
Yeah, and even sometimes you got to change your team members. I mean, even George Martin went and said, look, this Pete Best is not going to be a good drummer for you. And they went and got Ringo Starr. And so that was interesting. You've got to make sure that the right team's there, but you've got to develop your players as well. And I think it's about kind of building trust. And you've got to build the trust. Somebody has to trust that you're for their best interest before they can give you a challenge. Because without trust, can any communication work with somebody? Can any challenge work if they don't have that?
Only with a super high level individual, but there are not enough of them for that to be your normal modus operandi.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Now, I want to do like maybe a rapid fire round with you, just kind of some mic drop moments if we can. So think about this for a minute. Pause. What separates top performers from everyone else in one?
Execution.
Execution. I like that. Why do smart people fail?
Too much information. Not enough limitation. Yes, not enough constraints.
Help me flesh that out. I got lots of information. Information is good. How does that make me fail?
Information is good the same way that chocolate cake is good. It's good if you know how to control how much you eat. So information, you can get overload because you're spending so much time gathering information, getting smarter, that you forget the purpose of information is to do something with it. Constraints, when you have maybe very little information, very little time, or very few options, they force you into behavior because you have nothing else to do but to do something. So very smart people tend to over-index on intelligence, but under-index sometimes on execution. When you don't have a lot of information or a lot of options, you have no choice but to go do something. And in doing things, outcomes are achieved. You do not achieve outcomes by gathering information. Achieve outcomes by doing things. That's the execution.
Yeah. I think all people fail. Doesn't matter if you're smart, stupid, whatever. Everyone's going to go through failure. It's part of life. You've got to go through it. You've got to do it. We have different reasons why we fail. Smart people, you have a higher expectation that they're not going to fail, but sometimes their own knowledge gets in their way.
Yeah, they shouldn't have higher expectations, but they do.
Yep.
Yeah.
What do you think destroys momentum faster than anything else?
Getting in your own way. You destroy momentum is one side of a two-sided coin known as the law of inertia. Objects in motion tend to stay in motion. Objects not in motion tend to stay not in motion until or unless occupied, affected by an outside force. So when the momentum is going, the only thing that can stop the momentum is you doing something to stop the process. And usually when momentum is happening, you stop thinking so much, you stop processing so much, and you allow the flow to happen. Or some people talk about the flow state. When you get into that state, the only thing that stops momentum is usually people becoming too conscious of the process. And that's exactly when they mess it up. And often when we're flowing and we're getting the results that we want consistently is because we did less, not because we did more.
That's brilliant. I like that. How do you know when you're making excuses versus facing a real obstacle?
That's a great question. Often you don't know. You don't know. The best way to find out is the end of the story. You got to get to the end of the movie to find out if you made the right move or you made the wrong move. When I was trying to make it in basketball, had I not made it, we wouldn't be here having this conversation because it wouldn't be as sexy a story, you know, wherever I ended up. But because I did make it, now we're here. But I had to go through the story to find out. I might have been wasting my time. But because I made it, I wasn't wasting my time. And then at the same time, it very much depends on the person. Because let's say I kept trying and trying in basketball, didn't make it. And then I somehow figured out, how can I use that failure, so to speak, in sports and turn it into success in another way and became successful through a different door, then that could be part of my superhero story still. Or I could say, well, hey, I didn't make it in basketball, so I guess I'll just be an average person who nobody knows. It depends on the person, and it also depends on how the story goes.
That's good. What uncomfortable truth does every leader need to hear?
That every problem in your organization starts and ends with you. Always.
That's great. How do they respond when you tell them that?
Well, it depends on who they are.
Yeah, but that's true.
For most of them, it's a slap in the face. It depends on how they accept the slap in the face. Are they used to getting hit in the face? And some people are, some people are not. And once they get over it, usually they get over it. Some people within 10 seconds, some people it takes them a week. But once they get over it, then they're ready to address, okay, what do we need to do to fix this? Or what do I need to do? We being me and them. What do we need to do so that we can fix this situation? How can I adjust my approach? How can I adjust how I'm dealing with my team? How can I adjust my systems? How can I get a system? What can I do to take control and ownership over the situation? Because leaders need to accept that now, when you have a team, it is not the team's job to ease your burden. It is your job to ease their burden. A lot of people get that backwards.
Love that. Say that again.
It is not the team's job to ease your burden as a leader. It is your job as a leader to ease the burden of the team.
It's good. I want people to remember that. What is the biggest lie people tell themselves about success?
Biggest lie people tell themselves about success is that they can redefine success somewhere along the journey if and when it looks like they're not going to achieve their original definition of success. So we call that hedging your bets. I see this a lot. I don't know when this episode is coming out, but right now the basketball playoffs are going on, and you see a lot of players hedging their bets after they get eliminated and changing what success looks like because they know they're not going to win.
Yeah, that is really good. That's a mic drop moment right there. One habit that creates more results than almost anything else.
No self-negotiation allowed.
Okay. Flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, so what that means is when you tell yourself that something needs to happen or is going to happen, you are not allowed to negotiate with yourself about whether or not you're going to do what you said you would do, how, when, and where you said you would do it. A simple example. Person wakes up at 6 o'clock every morning. They say, Dre, I need to work out. I don't have time during the day. When I get home, my kids, family need me. So I guess I have to do it in the morning. So I'll wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning instead of 6 to get that workout in the morning. The next morning, their alarm goes off at 5 o'clock. What do most people do? Start negotiating. I had to hit the snooze button. Give me 15 minutes. Give me 30 minutes. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow. Maybe next week. And next time I talk to them, no, I got up at 6 o'clock every day last week because they started negotiating with themselves. And when you allow the negotiation, the human animal is designed to take the path of least resistance. This is our biological wiring. So when you allow yourself to negotiate, you will always negotiate down to the easiest possible path. But we all know that doing the easiest possible path rarely leads to the desired outcome. So we have to eliminate the need for negotiation or the option of negotiation. You eliminate the option. That's a constraint. When you give yourself constraints, that usually leads to more execution.
Personal accountability. Define it.
Well, what's an accountant? An accountant is a person whose job is to track every dollar in and out of any entity, an individual or an organization. And if a dollar is not where it's supposed to be, the accountant does not close the books until that dollar is found and accounted for. Personal accountability is the exact same thing. Everything that's supposed to be done needs to be tracked. It needs to be logged. I don't mean necessarily written down, but everything that's supposed to be done needs to get done. And until those things are done, then you as an accountant has not completed your job. And that requires a high level of personal ownership, because ownership and accountability are part of a three-part, they're two parts of a three-part package deal. The third part of that package deal is power. Every human being wants power. And I don't mean power over other people. You want power over yourself, your choices, and your life. With power, you must accept ownership and responsibility. They all come together. Same way that if you have a house, then you must accept somebody's got to cut the grass. That's part of the deal. You can't have one without the other.
Love it. Let me ask you this. What are you working on right now that genuinely excites you?
Well, this is something we touched on a little bit earlier, but focus right now is on only two areas. So one is the Power Presence Protocol, which is all about, that's for individuals, people who want to make sure their leadership lands the way it needs to land. They already have the information, they have the knowledge, they are capable, yet the response from the outside world is not reflective of their abilities. The Power Presence is about making that real through what is mostly unconscious communication. That's the Power Presence. For the team/organizational side, there's Execution Reliability Index. And that is about making sure that organizations have an execution enforcement layer that goes on top of your current systems that makes sure the system is actually being executed on properly. Does not replace your system, but it makes sure the system is being executed on so that that execution drift is not happening.
I like that. What challenges, if any, are you personally wrestling with right now? Not the polished version, the real one.
Breaking into the enterprise level business-wise. I'm pretty good on the individual level. I can sell a speaking gig. I can sell myself onto, I can get on somebody's show, like we're here. I can write a book. I can sell a course. I can sell a coaching client. Getting into the enterprise level to where I'm bringing a system in and not getting it because they're dazzled by me is because they're looking at the system and saying, okay, this is actually something useful. That's a whole different world. It seems like it's the same world, but those are two completely different worlds. And I'm trying to break through the ice right now.
But now, who shaped your leadership philosophy the most? And what did they teach you that you never heard anyone else say?
Most? That's an interesting question. I don't know if I can credit that to one person, Jim.
All right. Well, tell me about what books you would recommend as far as that's concerned.
All of yours. Yeah. Well, yeah, mine, but I won't cheat and give you mine. I'll give you my five of my favorites. Okay. Starting off, I would say Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. Mm-hmm. And I would give a B answer to that would be The Law of Success. Actually, The Law of Success was a bigger book. Think and Grow Rich was in The Law of Success. He just pulled it out and made Think and Grow Rich. That's the one that blew up. But I'll go Law of Success number one. My favorite author is a guy by the name of Robert Greene. Are you familiar with him? He wrote The 48 Laws of Power. Maybe you heard of that book.
Yeah. I've heard that. So I know that. Yeah.
So second one would be Robert Greene, 48 Laws of Power. He wrote The 50th Law with 50 Cent, 33 Strategies of War. All of those are some of my favorites. I would say, another, as far as leadership, I would say a person, not necessarily a book, but a person would be Earl Nightingale, The Strangest Secret. And it's 36 minutes long. You can find it on any of your audio platforms, Spotify, Apple for free. I've listened to that probably 100 times. Mm-hmm. When it comes to leadership, just dealing with people in general, those are probably my top three, because Napoleon Hill, I gave you two, Robert Greene, I gave you three, and Earl Nightingale, he had several books, but mostly I listen to his audios. Jim Rohn has a ton of audios. Brian Tracy has a book called Success Principles that I liked. Or was that? No, that was Jack Canfield. Brian Tracy had another one. I forget the name of his. but a lot of the older guys. I've listened to a lot of the older personal development stuff. All the stuff that's out now is just a new version of the stuff that's already been out for 100 years.
Yeah. Let's bring it to a close. Before anybody looks at their team, what should they see in the mirror?
Well, that's the question they have to answer first. What do they want to see in the mirror? And then compare that to what you do see in the mirror. And then we need to go to work on closing that gap. Because whatever you see in the mirror, that's the way you're projecting yourself out into the world. And if you look at what you're getting back from the world, it is a reflection of what you're projecting. And if you don't like what you're getting back, then we need to change what you're projecting. We change what you're projecting. We need to change how you see yourself. And to change how you see yourself, we have to do the inner work that most people don't see. All they see is the result of that.
Good. In one sentence, every leader listening, what would you want one thing that they could take away with them?
Communication of communication is unconscious and nonverbal. So how your team reads and responds to you is a reflection of how you're communicating outside of your words.
I love it. Dre, it's been a very quick hour, you know, that we've been talking here. I really loved it. I thank you for reaching out, and I thank you for coming on the podcast. I'm very excited about this. I just appreciate you. I appreciate all the things you're doing, and I appreciate you wanting to help other people grow and become better. So thanks for being on today. I appreciate you.
Jim, I appreciate you sharing your platform. Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely.